Benson's relation with Frankfurter were not good. Vandermeer was a very articulate man, very able. He could analyze a very complicated case, very simple, clear terms, and if a stenographer had taken down what he said, it would take very little polishing to make it into a fine opinion, but he froze when he picked up a pencil or a pen. His ideas did not run off the end of his fingers. He couldn't, he had great difficulty in expressing himself in the written word, and I think the statistics speak for themselves, but I think there were very few terms that he wrote more than about six opinions in the court. In many terms, that was Frankfurter's production, but not due to inability to write, but due to the fact that Frankfurter was spending most of his time on activities that had no relationship to the court, like getting people jobs, or getting people fired, or getting people promoted, or getting policies that he was in favor of adopted. Either domestically or in foreign affairs, getting ambassadors approved or disapproved, things of that kind.
I take it you much prefer that you, as a justice, much prefer the Hughes method of efficiency in court.
It doesn't make too much difference, actually. I would prefer the Hughes method because it would give the court an extra month in recess. And I think the extra month in recess over the long pull is good for the health of the court as an institution.
This Hughes, you know, said when he was, that he'd run for, had run as a presidential candidate once, and that he found that any one term in the Supreme Court more physically taxing than a presidential campaign. He dropped this in a note to Taft. There is a problem that has at least recurred in the past, and that is the retirement of Supreme Court justices. At least four justices were asked by their colleagues to leave the court. I wonder if any such instances occurred while you've been on the court, or if in light of your own experience and that of previous courts, you think that there should be a mandatory retirement age. Or if not, do you have any other solution, or do you feel that this problem occurs so seldom as not to be serious?
No such problem has occurred since I've been on the court. I've thought, however, that probably the best way to handle it would be a constitutional amendment limiting the judges to a fixed term of years, say like Pennsylvania, or I think they're limited to one 21-year term, or alternatively, retirement at a specified age, such as 70. It's difficult to make out a case of the need for it, because these kind of situations you mentioned don't commonly arise, so it's actually not a serious problem. But I think over the long history of the country, it would have probably have been better to have a limited term, say of 21 years, or retirement at 70. The reason is that all judges, like all executives or professors or deans or college presidents, they get into grooves and they develop calluses, all sorts of calluses, and they become immune to the infiltration of different ideas, or at least new ideas have difficulty getting through. And the more I'm inclined to think that the period of growth of a judge is very limited, and once he reaches that plateau where all his ideas become pretty fixed, it's time to get a new judge.
In off the bench statements, many justices have complained of the generally poor quality of oral argument before the court. I believe you once spoke of this in a letter to FDR. Do you now, since your letter to FDR was written shortly after you came to the court, feel that this criticism is, as a whole, valid? And would you explain what sort of oral presentation you prefer?
Well, I think that the criticism is valid. I would say that only about 40% of the arguments before the court are competent, have real quality. The rest are very pedestrian. Or if they're not pedestrian, they're on a plane that is very little utility to the court. Many spend their time trying to explain to the court what the decisions of the court mean, and it's kind of a waste of time to try to tell the judges what their opinions mean. The education that the judge needs on the case that is coming up is the education of the facts of this particular case, and by facts, not a deadly recitation of everything that happened, but a very short, concise summary of the relevant facts, and by those relevant facts, keep this case within the stream of set of decisions or call for an exception. And the arguments that are most helpful are those that do that. One other aspect of the matter pertains to the honesty, intellectual honesty of the lawyer. I don't mean to say that lawyers appear here who are dishonest in presenting or have guile or who will purposely mislead, but the tendency of people is to get enthusiastic about their cause. The tendency of lawyers is to overstate their record. Most effective advocates for our court are those who never overstate the record, who stay precisely within that record, and who show the one or two or three relevant facts that keep this case within the normal run, within the stream of the law, or make this case demand in the interests of justice or equity or whatnot that there be an exception. It's a factual argument rather than a legal argument that is most helpful.
I take it in the factual part that you would also include perhaps what the implications of this decision would be in the long run. That is the decision the lawyer is asking for. How it would affect existing law. As you put it, if he wants a change, what the effect this change would have?
Yes, that would be relevant if he has any idea on it. We grant, as you know, an hour on each side unless time is enlarged. I have found that lawyers use an hour whether they need it or not, and that it increases the quality of the argument to put a case on a summary docket, that is, give each side 30 minutes, because there are very few cases except those long involved cases with many points and deep involvement in factual variations that cannot be argued in 30 minutes. most of them can be. And I noticed that the lawyers from bars who have that practice, Pennsylvania, for example, always restricts lawyers to 30 minutes on appeal. Those lawyers who come here make probably the best arguments. They reduce the case to a capsule, and you'll find them back in their seat in 25 or 26 minutes. They're accustomed to the regime. The regime has made it imperative that they reduce the case to simple, relevant terms. And that usually can be done in 30 minutes.
I suspect that most professors' lectures would improve if they were cut from 50 to 30 minutes, too. In some appellate courts, it's a practice for the judges to have read the briefs before oral argument and to direct argument to certain limited points. I know the Supreme Court, except in re-argument, rarely directs argument. But as far as you know, do you think it is the general practice on the court for the justices to have carefully read the briefs before oral argument? I wonder if the cases are often discussed in conference prior to argument, that is, other than when the certiorari petition is brought up.
The court rarely directs argument. The only way we do that is on the grant of a petition for certiorari. We sometimes limit the grant to one or two points and specify what those points are. Or when we grant the petition, rephrase in our own terms the question that we want argued, and put that in the order granting certiorari or noting jurisdiction in the case of an appeal. We do read the briefs before oral argument. Cases that are not yet argued are not frequently discussed after the petition for certiorari is granted or after the jurisdiction, probable jurisdiction is noted in case of an appeal, unless there are other developments such as new cases in the same field or an act of Congress that bears upon this field, and then the problem is discussed. But generally we don't discuss the case prior to conference, prior to argument, except in the conference discussion when the petition is granted or the appeal noted.
Shortly after the school segregation cases in 1954, the Supreme Court refused to hear two miscegenation cases, Jackson versus Alabama and Nine versus Nine. I wonder if you could describe the conference discussion on these two cases.
These cases presented the question whether a state could make it a crime for a member of a white race to marry a member of the yellow race or a member of the black race. The there were three of us who felt that the state had no such power. At least we needed to be shown that the where that power could be found. Those three were Chief Earl Warren, Hugo Black, and myself. The opposition was headed by Frankfurter, who spoke at great lengths, who was convinced that this was just a run-of-the-mill police power case. It was as clear that the state had the power to prevent this as it did to prevent nuisances prevent houses over fire traps, that the purity of the race was as legitimate a subject for legislation as the purity of milk or the purity of water, the healthful condition of housing and so on. He was very vocal, very clear, very demanding in this case. He spoke at great length, great feeling, pounding the table, shouting. Began to feel that perhaps he was less sure on the inside than he seemed to be on the outside. The vehemence was trying to make up for perhaps a weakness in his own position that he felt. I thought that as a result of these long discussions on these two cases, that the Frankfurter position, if it could be honestly stated, was that this was no time for the court to be arousing the people of the South any more than they are already aroused, and that therefore he was willing to cast principles aside. But it seemed to the three of us that this was such a highly personal thing, as personal as a matter of one's belief or one's opinions or one religion, that we were entering a domain that in a free society it should be of no concern to government. At least we felt that it must open and shut. We wanted it to argue. But it takes four to grant a certain. That's the reason that those were not granted.
I was wondering if anyone made this political argument overtly in the conference.
No, I don't. Not that I recall.
I had just guessed and had written something on this. Well, it hasn't published yet, but I had made a guess that this. The argument that you ascribed is that the real one of Frankfurt is possibly the real one behind the decision, the denials, and in this case, that just exactly what you had said, that you felt Frankfurt's real position was. Because it would seem to me that if the school segregation is unconstitutional, that it certainly must be unconstitutional to choose to forbid a person to choose his marriage partner because of race. Would you describe the conference at the last hearing of the Rosenberg case after you had granted a stay of execution?
As I recall, I granted the stay on the 16th of June. Or it might have been the 17th of June, 1953, after oral argument in my chambers. This was a Second Circuit case. Justice Jackson was Circuit Justice of the Second Circuit. I was headed west. I was alone driving my car to the state of Washington. And my first stop was going to be in St. Louis. I had an engagement to see Irving Gilliard, who was an old friend of mine, connected with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And adjourned on Monday. This was Tuesday. And I was, unfortunately, I came to the office. And instead of leaving right from my home, I say unfortunately because when I came to the office, the counsel in the Rosenberg case were there asking me to stay the execution, which I think was set for Thursday. I told them that this was a Second Circuit case and that the application should go as a matter of custom and propriety to Justice Jackson. And they said, well, the reason that we're giving it to you is that we know that we want to have time to present it to Jackson and then present it to you because we understand that you're leaving town or driving west, which was the fact. How they knew it, I don't know. Perhaps somebody in my office inadvertently told them. I told them that a justice didn't grant a stay in any case from another circuit without the, if the circuit justice of that circuit was available. And so they got a hold of Jackson, and Jackson called me and told me that he thought I should pass on the motion since I was leaving town. The fact that he hadn't passed on it was immaterial, that he would not consider it improper for me to entertain it. So I asked the government and to come in, and counsel for Rosenberg to come in. We had an oral argument. My law clerk had left the city for the summer. He was taking a bar examination, I think, in Arizona. So I borrowed one of the Black's law clerks. And after the oral argument, he and I went to work on it. We worked intensively on it until about 11 o'clock at night. The point presented, namely the effect, if any, of the change in the punishment while the crime was being committed, that point had never been presented to any court. The case had been to us several times, but after we checked the district court records and the court of appeals record and the petitions that had been filed from various times with us, I realized that this was a new point that had never been considered by any court. And I had difficulty in concluding that it was a frivolous question. The crime was a crime of conspiracy. The conspiracy, as I recall, that was charged and was proved, extended over a four-year period. When the conspiracy started, there was a death penalty attached. After the conspiracy was 2 years old, the statute was changed so as to make the death penalty not mandatory, but permissive on the recommendation of the jury. And there had been no such instruction to the jury. The old law had been assumed to be applicable, that is the law in existence at the time the conspiracy was started, rather than the law as it was amended during the commission of the conspiracy. The limits of the record to see what the proof was. We found that the essence of the case, the guts of the case against the Rosenbergs, was made up of episodes that occurred after this law had been amended, most incriminating evidence against them. And I always felt from reading this record that the Rosenbergs certainly were guilty of some federal crime in connection with the attempt at least to transmit secrets to Soviet Russia. I did not want to grant the stay. I did not want to grant it at least that day. I wanted to sleep on it. So about 11 o'clock at night, I left the court building and went up to see the Chief Justice, Fred Vinson. The Washington was pretty excited. There were pickets around the White House, and there were pickets around the pickets. There were masses of people milling around the courthouse. There were about 200 cameramen and newspapermen in the hall waiting for me to make a ruling. I wouldn't talk to them. I slipped out the back way and left by way of the garage. Went out to the Sheraton Park where Fred Vinson lived. And had a long talk with him about it that night. I said I didn't come to him for advice, but I just thought I'd better tell him that I turned up a very troublesome question that had never been presented to any court before, and that since this was a death case, I was inclined to think that some court should hear it. He had never considered the matter before, the point of law before, but he immediately undertook to demonstrate to me that the point was a frivolous point. And the more that he talked, the more convinced I became that the point had some substance. So I left him about 1 o'clock in the morning to get some sleep and returned to the office about 10 o'clock in the morning. And when I woke that morning, thought about it, I decided that I had only one course to do, and that would be to grant a stay. They were to die the next day. That was a Thursday. I think I'm right on that. Well, anyway, I think they had only a day or so to live, and that nobody could really rule on it, and get briefs and arguments on it, make up his mind on it in that short time. And therefore, I prepared a stay that would permit the question to be presented to the district court. Then by that time, our court had reconvened in October. The Court of Appeals doubtless would have expedited it and heard it. The case would be, the point of law would be before us on a petition for certiorari, which we could either grant or deny. But by that time, it would have been explored by two courts and found to be have merit or found to be of no merit. So I issued the stay, and I left town by car, thinking that dispose of until next fall. I had got, as a result of the late start, I reached some point south of Pittsburgh by dusk and registered in a motel, and I heard announced on the car radio as I was coming into the motel that the Chief Justice had called a special session of court for the next morning to pass on the my stay order. I left the my bags at the motel and went back to the nearest town to call my office to see if that report was true. If so, to advise Vincent that I'd be on hand for the session. Third, to arrange transportation to find out how I could get back, where I'd leave the car, and so on. I called my office and discovered that the Vincent had called the court into a special session for 12 o'clock the next day. Advised my office to advise him that I would be on hand. The one of the things that judge disturbed me was that there had been no effort to reach me. Vincent knew where I was going, he knew the route I was on, he knew I was driving. And a simple alert to the Pennsylvania police would have got the message to me, and I could have been advised. But he was not interested in getting me there. He was interested in getting the stay vacated. I went back to the motel, having discovered that I would have to drive to Pittsburgh and that I could catch an early plane out of Pittsburgh that would get me to Washington in time for the argument. So I went back to the motel to get my bags, and as I drove into the grounds where the motel was located, my headlights picked up a huge crowd of people that had assembled around the place where I was staying. And the mood of Washington, D.C. had been so ugly that I thought this was a mob that had come to pay their, tell me what they thought of me and perhaps to do something about it. I stopped the car and turned off the headlights and stepped out. A man stepped up and asked me if I was Justice Douglas, and I said I was. He turned to the crowd and a very loud voice says, "It's him." And three or four men rushed up and grabbed me. I thought it was, momentarily, that it was for a lynching or some acts of violence. Actually, they put me up on their shoulders and, in a very embarrassing way, carried me about a mile to a picnic that they were having. These were Eastern European coal miners. They were rough, uneducated men, had their wives and children, this big picnic. And they were overjoyed at the, not at the Rosenbergs, but particularly, but at the feeling that justice was about to, that justice hadn't gone down the drain, that there was, there was going to be a hearing. It was very difficult for me to get away from that crowd. After a delay of an hour or so, I got back to my car, drove through Pittsburgh, and caught the plane, and got to court in time. We had a preliminary conference prior to 12 o'clock. Black raised the question that Vincent had no power to convene a court, that no Chief Justice had the power to convene a court, that the Chief Justice was not like the manager of a baseball club or a football team, that a court could convene only on a majority of a vote of the court. And Black was clearly right. In my view, when the vote came to me on that, I stated that I thought Black was right, but that I would defend the right of the Chief Justice to summon the court to take a vote on whether or not a court should be convened, and that I would cast my vote to convene the court. And that was Black thereupon withdrew his opposition, and we went into the courtroom to hear the argument. After the argument, we came back to the session to consider it, and I asked for a vote of the conference on whether or not the stay as issued should stand. And on that, the vote was 5-4. Those who voted to let the stay exist to stand were Black, myself, and Burton. Frankfurter passed, but later changed his position and voted that it should stand and that the district court should hear argument and we'd have a chance to pass on it.
Could die on Thursday night.
machinery of the court, of the federal courts would work was to execute the Rosenbergs on the Friday night. But it was clear that the Rosenbergs had to die. The country was out for blood. The court was blind to any reason. Vinson was filled with passion to such an extent that he could hardly utter a calm word. This was the closest I've ever seen to, in my own personal experience. I've read things of this effect, but my own personal experience, this is the only time I'd ever seen the spirit of a mob, the spirit of the streets, dominate a court. Rosenberg died Friday night, and the whole country had exulted in some strange orgasm of hate. Vinson died later in 3-4 months. He was at the American Bar Association meeting in Boston in August of that year, a month before his death. My brother, who was a lawyer, but who at that time was president of the Statler Hotel system, happened to be in Boston at the same hotel, and Vincent heard that my brother was there and called my brother to his suite and went into the whole Rosenberg case. And by August, which was 2 months later, the Rosenbergs were dead. The mob had tasted his blood. Fred Vinson was a sad man. He was sorry at what had happened. He had he looked back upon this last judicial act in his life as with sorrow and misgivings, regret. And he told my brother that I had been right, he would have been wrong, and he wanted to do everything he could in the rest of his life to try to clear my name of any wrongdoing and to make up for this great injustice that had been done. Rather sad. Nobody knew at that time that Fred had only a month to live, but perhaps he had some premonition.
Yes,